Pop Talk and Aliens, the William Clear Podcast.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. My name is William Clear. This is Pop Talk and Aliens, and it is a podcast. 10th episode, ladies and gentlemen. Very happy to have gotten to 10. See how many more we can do. Just keep doing it until nobody listens anymore. But I think you will want to hear this one. You'll want to listen because my guest in this episode is Carla Kane. Quick little intro on Carla, if you're not familiar. She is the lead singer, songwriter, founder of the Corner Laughers. It's an amazing pop band here in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's also a member of Agony Ants, another amazing band, a great eclectic pop band out here in the Bay Area. And she plays ukulele in that pop band, which is awesome. Ukulele in a pop band, and it totally works. She's also, I'll give myself a plug here, she's also a member of my band, William Clear and the Marvelous Fellas. You can check out her Corner Laughers work at cornerlaughers.com. Check out some Agony Ants at facebook.com/GreaterMiranda. And if you want to check out William Clear and the Marvelous Fellas, that would be facebook.com/WCFellas. But that's not all. Carla is also the arts editor for Palo Alto Weekly, and you can check that out at paloaltoonline.com. So the qualifications never end. And even when you think they've just ended, no. Her and her husband, Coy Wynn, who also plays in Corner Laughers, and William Clear and the Marvelous Fellas, and Agony Ants, and he subs in for bands all over the world because he plays 16 different instruments, will join us in and out in this episode, as will their beautiful darling daughter, Octavia A. Kane. So you get to hear from Octavia as well. And so to bring you in, why don't we have Octavia do it with a little bit of the Corner Laughers song from their last album, Matilda Effect, the song Octavia A. And then we'll get it rolling, talking to Carla Kane. Let's get it on. Highly anticipated episode. Carla Kane is here. Coy Wynn will be joining later.
Hello.
Hi, Carla.
This is very long awaited by us, even.
Well, you know, so what happened was I was going to, I was doing an episode about alien something. And then we were going to do an episode right after that because I was going to Europe. But then Europe thing happened, like, you know, everything happened so fast that all of a sudden I was back from Europe, and then, you know, we all have kids, we're trying to schedule and everything, so I threw in a Morrissey episode in between, but now, here we are.
I am planning on revisiting Morrissey. I enjoyed the episode.
Thank you.
So I have to give him more of a chance. More, if you will.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, I definitely, I'll make you up a starter package, but if I were going to start at one place, I would go You Are the Quarry. You Are the Quarry, because it's got a nice eclectic mix of different types of material. Some of his other albums are very, like, you know, this one's all guitars, this one's all this type of thing, this one's too weird. You Are the Quarry, solid pop album.
All right.
Very accessible. Very accessible. So Carla is the founder of the Corner Laughers, and the Corner Laughers now consist of Carla and Coy and Charlie Crabtree, who's been on the show, and Casey Bowman, who is a sought-after guest on this podcast. I don't even think Casey listens to this thing, which is even the better. Because I'll grab him with, like, he'll have no frame of reference as to what this is all about, and I'll just start talking to him. Just throw a mic in his face. It'll be entertaining.
Like a Michael Moore.
Yes.
Ambush.
Ambush. I'll totally just ambush him. I'm going to talk to Bradley Scott about Morrissey at some point
soon. That's going to be a good, yeah.
Because it turns out
that's a good team.
Yeah, I've never met him, but he
really
seems like we would get along like a house on fire.
Oh, yeah.
Because he actually sent me some messages correcting me on a couple of things that I had wrong on the Morrissey podcast, which I realized after I was done that I had wrong, but it was too late to go fix it. So just for those of you hardcore Morrissey fans, Vinnie Riley is a guitarist, not a drummer. I refer to him as a drummer, and he's a guitarist. But anyway, Carla is also a member of Agony Ants, which is the same personnel, and William Clear and the Marvelous Fellas, which just happens to be me, which is also the same personnel, plus me.
Well, you're also Agony Ants, so.
I do guest with Agony Ants. And you know what? That's a good thing to bring up. You guys have four albums as Corner Laughers, two as Agony Ants, as we were talking about before we started. I can't think of a bad review that you have ever gotten as the Corner Laughers, and deservedly so. But I wanted to ask you if you ever got one, because I have a story to tell you about a bad one that I got, but I want to hear first if you
had one. Yeah, we have. I'm trying to think. There's some that are just kind of, you know, mediocre, which is worse. I mean, you'd rather get a really bad one, I think. I'm trying to think. There was one really bad one. I think it was of Ultraviolet Garden. I forget what it is. I'll look it up for you. But sometimes there's somewhere they're like trying to be complimentary, but they're offensive to us.
Right.
Like clearly they haven't listened to any lyrics or anything, you know, except maybe the first song, and then wrote a review.
Those are the worst. I think we had a couple of those with, I mean, our William Clear and the Marvelous Fellas album didn't get a ton of reviews, but it got way more than I thought it would. And some of them, most of them were great. And I was like, I couldn't believe that people liked it. And like, I really couldn't. I expected just to have nothing but comparisons to Elton John. And there were plenty of those, which is fine. I don't mind being compared to him because I'm so derivative of... I learned how to play piano by listening to Elton John. So that's going to happen. But a review... There was a review of Agony Ants' last album where I sang the song You're So Vague. And the reviewer, like, zeroed in on that song and hated it. Do you remember this review? She said it was like unlistenable or unendurable.
I can't remember.
Or something.
You'll have to. Do you remember what, like?
I don't remember. What? There's little Octavia in the background. If you can hear it, I don't know. The microphones are pretty close, but she swings. She sings so sweet, like her mom and her dad, and I think she will definitely follow in your footsteps. But that interview, that review of You're So Vague was like so hardcore bad that I wear it as a badge of honor.
I can't remember it, but I want to.
I think she kind of didn't like the whole album. I remember she said something like, I feel like, there was one song that she said, like, I feel like I'm listening to an inside joke, which she probably
fair,
is, kind
I of. Guess. I mean, that's kind of what I like about Agony Ants. So.
I love that about them, yes. Well, I also have like, but anyway, yeah, so she hated You're So Vague. But that's a good point about Agony Ants. And it's something I wanted to ask you about is how you guys come up with the songs. Like, for me as a songwriter, I don't write very often. I have to be like around a piano all the time, play it a bunch, and then after like a couple of weeks, I'll start thinking of things. And usually I'm constantly tapping into the same well of material. Like, you know, the life, the existential weird stuff about life or girls that I used to date or whatever. Or I try to make some sort of observation about something or whatever. It's not a huge breadth of material that I draw from. But you guys come up with like a title, like, and I'll use an example. There's a song that you have called Back to Back Bills. And I know how that title came to be. It was because, if I'm right, we were playing a set, the Bill Band and you guys, and then for some reason something happened, so we decided for the Bill Band to go two sets in a row. Right?
It was like there was a bunch of bands, and we were trying to help arrange the order, I guess. And I think it was that we didn't want to have to move the piano
right
around. It would be better to have back-to-back Bill. As it were.
And then you came up with a song called that, which was not about that, and it was about William Tell. And I thought it was about William Tell and William Burroughs, but it was...
Well, now it is, I think, because of you recognizing that and bringing that idea. Now I think it totally makes sense, and we didn't even know what it was about, really.
Mountain Ranger, the overture's over. Strangers betrothed.
until
See, that's what's amazing to me. Like we were in LA one time playing with Alan Clapp's orchestra, which we also all play for. And you guys were going to write a song about Fatburger. I remember, like, in the hotel.
Yeah,
after
you
the
and Charlie took a cab to Fatburger. I got like a text from Charlie that was like, "Me and Bill, oh, we're taking a cab to Fatburger," and that just struck us as hilarious for some reason.
And the fact that that could even cross your mind as a song is amazing to me. And also, I remember, by the way, for anyone who hasn't been to Fatburger, please go to Fatburger.
I haven't been to Fatburger.
See, you should have come.
Well, I didn't. It was too late. I just got the text that.
That's true. We got there and we slept, and then we woke up like in. We had like 45-minute window, and I demanded we go to Fatburger. So we took a cab to Fatburger. But so okay. So how do you take a song title, like Back to Back Bill, and create something like that out of it?
Well, that Back to Back Bill, I'm pretty sure Casey wrote all the lyrics. So. You'll have to go to him for that one.
Okay.
Other than we all singing back-to-back Bill in the moment that we used the phrase. But I believe he turned it into the actual song, Back-to-back Bill.
Here's Coy, ladies and gentlemen. Coy Lynn.
I've missed out on the question, but I'm helping.
I'm trying to drill into how you guys write. And I was using back-to-back Bill as an example. But there's other songs. Okay, so let me take an... Oh, Sugar Skull. The other day, I had my iPod on shuffle in my car. Came on. Awesome. Totally enjoyed it. Haven't heard it in a long time. And I don't remember the lyrics that I was thinking of at the time, but you rhyme like... And you do this all the time. You rhyme like three words that are so unusual, so quickly, that... I mean, it boggles my mind. It's like... How?
Yeah, I like to do it. I like to hear rhymes. Someone's skin like alabaster. Someone's face that casts in plaster. It's a beautiful disaster. Beautiful disaster. And all the saints around my arms could not protect us from all harm. And when I hear you play the harp, all other songs are in F sharp. You said as you touched every string.
All right, so how long does that take?
I don't write songs very often either. And I'm kind of like you, like I can have an idea, like a piece of an idea for a long time before I actually do anything with it. Once I have, you know, a verse, then the rest is easy.
Right.
Because I can just play off that theme
and
figure out rhymes. And that's the fun part after you get past like the initial block.
I have that exact same thing. I have a song that you guys know that we are hopefully going to record soon called Phoenix Lights.
Yes. Obviously, which I've learned about from this podcast now.
Right. And now you know what that actually means. So, but I loved that title so much, but I didn't want to write a song about, you know, a UFO sighting. You guys could pull that off. See, I couldn't do something like that. So I turned it into this song about this girl I met in Arizona. But that song literally took me 10 years to figure out. 10 years. It was, and then as soon as I got the first verse, I was done in a week. Speaking of recording our new album, I have, being 41 now, and because we go so long without recording, because it takes me forever to write, I'm putting what I like to call an epitaph song on the album, which is otherwise known as an I'm going to die soon song, or if I die soon song. So here's what I wanted to ask you about. So a lot of older artists, as they get like older, I feel like they always kind of throw in these like,
you know, the, you know, Walk Hard.
Yes.
Like when he dies on and has this song about how he died.
Right. Not Dark Yet, Bob Dylan was one I was thinking of too. Like that's one of my favorite, like I might die soon. But then it's like he lived like another 20 years and he's done like 10 albums since then. Elton John wrote some, and then I think that he got to the point where Bernie Taupin decided that if Elton John was going to die, he would have died already.
Right. And now so he's immortal.
Yeah, they just stopped writing those. Like his songs, his albums don't even, there's no like impending.
There's probably like some Brian Wilson ones like he's that too. Like now he's past that point.
Right. Yeah, totally. If Brian Wilson was going to die, he would have died.
Yeah.
Jerry Garcia wrote quite a few of those with, I mean, it was a good idea to do so. So Many Roads, I don't know if you know this song, So Many Roads, Days Between, definitely prophetic, Just In Case I Die songs. But anyway, I have one working for this album, Just In Case. It's called Sundial. You guys haven't heard it yet, but Corner Laughers, you do like an album every 3 years or so?
Yeah, it's been actually exactly every 3 years, yeah. But usually we've had the song, well, I guess it depends. Yeah, I mean, it takes a long time.
Yeah. We did our album, our Marvelous Fellas album. It was funny because we recorded it in a day, but then it took a year and a half after that to get it done. But a lot of that time I was out of commission and not functioning well. So that wasn't fun. Okay, so let me ask you about Back to the Future.
Okay.
This is something I've been thinking a lot about lately since they had the anniversary last year.
Right.
So you guys used to do a Back to the Future marathon after Thanksgiving, where we'd all come over and we'd watch Back to the Future. It was awesome. So there's a couple of things about that movie. The first is my brother used to complain incessantly about how in the first Back to the Future, after Marty fixes everything with his parents and they become, all confident and rich and everything, he comes back in time and they got the nice truck and the car and they got Biff as their slave. But they still live in that same house.
Yeah. A lot of it, it's hard for me anyway. I mean, obviously it's just a movie and it's not real. But if you start thinking about, is time a loop or not?
Right.
So does it always just, is it always just happening where it starts out with that house and they work for Biff and then he changes the past and then they still,
Right. Or if you're slipping off.
Why? I mean, I guess they still have nostalgia for, what is it? The Lion Estates.
Right.
So that, that means something to them.
That's a good point because Lion Estates was such a big deal.
Yeah.
When he sees it. All right. So we've come to, or at least you've helped me come to peace with a plot point in Back to the Future.
Well, I guess, do they talk about it as teenagers? That's the aspirational. I know Marty sees it.
They don't. He sees it, but it's
assumed that everyone's watching it.
Yeah. Because it's got the big, it seems like it's just the place that everyone's going to go once they build it. And there's a lot, probably here's another theory I have. There was a really long waiting list for it, because it was so big. And so that they got on that waiting list really early on and then they got the house. And so they, they stayed there because Lion Estates was so great. And then after that, they flipped the house.
I mean, yeah. And when you see that, compared to, I guess it's Marty's grandparents' house. That house is awesome. That neighborhood when George gets hit with the car.
Oh yeah, they have an awesome house. Yeah. Totally. It's huge on that huge street.
An old craftsman.
Yeah. See, they did, they got lazy.
But, it was different. They like the new, modern.
Right.
Style of.
It was such an 80s style. And it's funny because in Back to the Future 2, their prediction of the future is just an extension of 80s stuff. It's everyone's still wearing fluorescent things and, but everything's cleans itself and you don't have to tie your shoes and stuff, but it's exactly the same thing you'd wear in the 80s. Which brings me to flying cars and the feasibility of flying cars. And why so much science fiction always would predict flying cars. Do you think that a flying car would have ever happened? Was that when you were a kid? Did you ever think that there would be flying cars? Not like a little kid, but like, you know.
No, that I really spent much time thinking about it, but
I spent a lot of time.
I mean, we have airplanes, right?
Right.
So, why would you also need a flying car? Well, I mean, would it be so much easier to fly a car than compared to, you know, the difficulty of actually having your own airplane and piloting it? I don't know.
It would be ridiculously difficult.
Seems like it would be to me.
To me, it would be a terror in the skies all the time. Imagine like a car accident now.
Yeah, and think how regulated, you know, air traffic is.
Right. You can't just have. Can you? This is what I've thought about because I think about these ridiculous things. Can you imagine, like, if there were flying cars and they were, like you said, you know, they'd have to have regulated routes and everything. So there'd be, like, stoplights hanging in the sky. And they could fall over and kill you at any time. And if there was a car accident in the sky, it would just be raining horror down on everyone. Yeah. It'd be, like, it would be raining blood.
And there would still probably be cars, you know, on the ground.
Right. So there'd be cars falling from the sky into the cars on the ground. I always thought self-driving cars would have been the more natural, like...
Now, that I do like.
Those will be awesome.
That's... Yeah.
I was thinking about... Like, I was driving here today, down 101, during just mad traffic, and people change lanes so often, right? And it causes so many problems. And I was thinking, when self-driving cars come in, that, like, so much of that's going to be eliminated, because they're not going to change lanes just so they can gain 5 inches. I actually worked at Google for a little while, and I got to sit in a self-driving car. Not when it was moving. I just got to sit in it for a second, and it looked basically like a regular car.
Yeah.
It's like a Lexus, but instead of button.
I've seen them a lot lately driving.
I heard that people, like really rich people, had them. Is that true? I can't imagine that anyone actually drives
them. I thought it was only Google
people. I think so. Yeah. I can't imagine that people are just randomly driving those things. But you know, the first time one of those things kills someone, people are gonna be outraged.
I know, and it's like, look how dumb people are at driving. Like,
yeah,
they're
dying all the time.
But I know, like, Google people use them like for their commutes.
Right, they're allowed to drive on the highway and stuff now.
Yeah.
Because she's at the store.
You do a little commercial for them right now, that would be perfect. But you don't have commercials on this.
I'll make one for that.
It's a good store.
Gray Matter store?
Palo Alto. Store. Yeah. It's all like smart toys and games.
Oh.
But they're fun, not annoying.
That is a good transition, because I was about to talk about France and how their education system is better because they can all speak a little bit of English. A lot of them can speak a lot of it. I mean, I only ran into, you know, they talk about rude French people.
Yeah.
I only ran into one rude French person. Like, I went into this store and it was really weird. And obviously everything was written in French and I can't even begin to, I'm educated on a pop-up book that has quote unquote phonics in it. Thank you. I was only in London for 2 days and we were staying, unfortunately, we're in Muswell Hill. Do you know where that is?
From the Kinks, yeah.
Is it really? Oh, that's where we stayed.
That's awesome.
It was great. It was a great little place, but it's far away from London. Or it's not, I mean, it's not super far, but it's a long bus ride. So we went back and forth to London, so we kind of had to, like, keep it moving, you know, and see all the big spots and everything. So we went to, but I had to go to Tin Pan Alley, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Denmark Street,
which... I didn't get to spend enough time on, but Charlie said that you guys played there?
Yeah, we've played there a few times.
It's really kind of being torn down.
Just recently, yeah.
Well, it was, when I saw it, it was just like, it was a bunch of music stores, which I thought was cool that it was music, but there wasn't like...
Yeah, the venue where we played a few times, which was called the 12 Bar Club, and it's like a building from the 1600s. But it just closed, like, last year.
Mm-hmm. I didn't get to spend enough time there, which I was kind of bummed about. I didn't get to really explore it. I did go... See, I went on my little Elton John tour of, like, stuff, you know, places that he was in his early days. And so Denmark Street was one of them. But he, on New Oxford Street is where he like recorded Empty Sky and where he wrote a bunch of the songs that ended up on Tumbleweed Connection. So I spent a lot of time there, and that place has totally changed. It was a nightmare. When we first got to London, we had booked an Airbnb in a place called Hackney.
Yeah.
See, you guys have been all over. I got to go back to that country. I saw a ton of France and a ton of Barcelona, but I didn't see enough London, of England. So we got this place in Hackney, and like the guy wasn't there, but he left a key like under the door, and then we walked in, but it was like there was like garbage on the floor and a bike, and then there was another key that we're supposed to go into another room, and we couldn't figure out what room it was, and so we went in the back because it was supposed to be like this sort of like cottage house or something, right? But it was this maze of brick walls, and one of the brick walls had like a nuclear sign on it. And it, I mean, it was like clearly a joke or whatever, but it was scary, and it was at night. And so we finally just said, forget this. We're not going to stay here. So we got a cab and asked us to take us to like a motel or something. And he took us to this place. We get in there, pay for the room, go up, and the room is full of flies that are like the size of like a full thumb. Full of them. So we go back down and we're like, dude, there's flies in this room. And so he's like, oh, I'll give you another room. So we go up to this other room. It doesn't have a bathroom. And the bathroom is like in the hall and there's towels all over the place. So finally, this guy, he's driving all over the place. He's like pre-charged us like 30 pounds or something, which was really like turned out to be very low for all of the driving this guy did. But anyway, that's how we ended up staying at Muswell Hill. So I went to, but the next day, the first thing on our way to London, we stopped at New Oxford Street, which is where Elton John recorded his first album and everything that I was telling you about. And it was also where history has it that there was a pub on that street where Bernie Taupin convinced Elton John not to marry this girl that he was with. And that was Someone Saved My Life Tonight. So I was like, oh, I got to see this place. And but the area is totally different. It's all like business now and stuff, right? So I was thinking, if I saw a pub, I would have decided that that was it. And I would have like, you know, made a little pilgrimage to it. But there was not even a pub. You guys got to go to Liverpool and do all that stuff. I mean, what was that experience like? Because you got to play music there.
Yeah, we stayed in some bad... Well, that was the worst place we ever stayed in.
Which is where?
In London. It was just like a... I think it was for like backpackers and...
Yeah.
But it had... Like we were on this tiny attic room in the very, very top floor. No bathroom. There was a... Like two levels down, there was... a toilet room, and then below, like a level down, there was a shower room, and then like all the way on the bottom, there was a sink that worked room. So you had to, you know,
you couldn't do all three.
No, you had to take three trips to, you know, for one bathroom experience.
Wow.
But
and we had a window that wouldn't close.
Oh, and it was freezing, of course, and we got really sick. And
yeah,
it was pretty good. But yeah, we've done what, four tours in England?
We got a room in Barcelona that we also had to leave. We went into this room in Barcelona, and there were three beds, and about a foot between the beds and the wall. So it was literally just a box full of beds. And there was the communal kitchen outside of the room, which reeked so bad of like old fish. And I got so sick that I threw up and I missed the afternoon. I missed the early part of the next day. I just had to sleep because I was so sick from that place.
We've always had good luck with Airbnb, I think, pretty much. We've had... can't think of any really bad experiences yet.
We had one. The place we stayed in France was awesome. It was an apartment. This woman named Alice. She like her house. It was so colorful. It was kind of like yours. Like it was just this beautiful colors everywhere. This was the best place we stayed. We were there for three nights. She had like a record player with Simon and Garfunkel and stuff. It was so awesome. But she had like this. She was obviously like a real film buff. She had like movies everywhere, and she had her VHS cassettes.
They were VHS. Her dead ball.
I know, I should have. Part of it takes place in France. Oh!
Oh, yeah.
That's something I wanted to tell you. I was almost going to message you this. So Carla and I and Coy and Charlie and Casey, made a movie called Deadball. It's about baseball in the 1800s. And you can get it on Amazon.com. When we are in France in that movie, we show the Eiffel Tower, and then there's a building that Charlie and I are in, just like a hotel or something, where I like superimpose this in the window. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was making that scene, I was looking at these old maps of Paris and trying to figure out like where buildings were in relation to the Eiffel Tower at that time, because it was like the time that they went to play there was like right when it was unveiled. It had like just opened, which was a big thing and why they wanted to play there. And the building that I kind of got an idea from this old map is, and then I got a picture of, is the building that's there. Wow. I was so happy. I was like, that movie is geographically correct, because the building, like, they're old. It's still, there's a row of these old, old apartment type buildings next to the Eiffel Tower. And that was it. And I looked up at it and I was like, oh my God, that is the shot from the movie. And it amazed me to walk around that field thinking that those guys played there.
I think next for Deadball, you should adapt it into a stage play.
I think it would be best as a stage play.
I think it would work really well.
It's also like it looks like a stage play. Most of the shots are like four people. Because that's, I don't really know how to direct film, you know. So I just like kind of line everybody up by height and do a shot of all four of them, and like there you go, everybody walks in one at a time, and you have a little triangle of height, and it would be a good
play. It's a really interesting story.
It's a great story. Speaking of bad reviews, there's a bad review of it on Amazon, but he does say that he learned a lot from it. So it was like you were talking about earlier, about like where they kind of give you a compliment but also not, because he says like it's cheesy and low budget, but I learned a lot from it. Speaking of theater, so you have reviewed theater. What are some of the better plays that you've reviewed?
Wow. I've seen a lot now, because my day job is, if you will, theater critic and an arts editor. And there's a lot of good companies around here. Like, I'm always finding out more and more. City Lights in San Jose is a really good company.
They've been forever, right?
Yeah.
They've been around forever.
Theater Works is always good. Pear Theater is a really tiny company in Mountain View. It's always good. We just saw one a few weeks ago called The Beard of Avon. It's like a Shakespearean comedy. It was really funny. In downtown Redwood City, there's a teeny tiny one called Dragon. There's Palo Alto Players. And San Jose has a whole bunch.
Yeah.
And then there's Sunnyvale and Los Altos, and ones I'm not as familiar with. But
do you ever see Sunnyvale plays?
I've never seen one.
They just did Rent at Sunnyvale
Community
Theater.
Stanford just did Rent, too.
Sunnyvale, I did millions of plays at Sunnyvale Community Theater when I was a kid. And they were always low budget. Like, I did the play Superman, which I've shown you a clip of me doing that.
As Superman.
As Superman. So the play was so, it was low budget and everything. I was supposed to fly in a couple of scenes on this big rig, there was this rig that I was supposed to come down with, and I had this huge, gigantic belt. It would have been completely obvious to the audience, right? I mean, there would have been no way to hide it. But at least the kids would get to see Superman fly. But then the plan was that there would always be a crowd around me every time I flew in, so that they could take my belt off while they were like, cheering for me and hugging me and stuff. And then the insurance didn't work out or something, so I couldn't have a rig and I wasn't going to fly at all. And I was so bummed, because I was like, I wanted to fly, but then I also like, kids are going to come see this and Superman's walking around all the time. So we worked it out to where there were six guys, like actors in the play and stagehands, that would line up off stage and like fold their, cross their arms with each other and make like a landing pad. So I would jump off of like tables into them. And it looked awesome though, and people would cheer. But then when I came on stage, I would jump off a table and land kind of like a cat, where I'd like bend down so I didn't fall. But one time, I totally bailed. I just slid all over the stage. And then I had a prepared ad lib in case that happened. And I got up and I said, I haven't had a landing like that since Chernobyl. Because it was like 2 years before. maybe it was too soon, but everyone laughed. But it's, so Sunnyvale has done, their production value has gone down and down and down over the years. Mm-hmm. And it's made me really sad because I've always done plays there. And, but they did Rent, and I think they're still doing it. And it's like selling out. People are reviewing it. It's like the biggest play they've done ever.
I mean, yeah, I haven't seen, I don't think I've ever seen one in Sunnyvale. I usually, like, almost always when I'm seeing a play, there's a moment when I try and think about if you were in the play, what part you would be.
Me?
And there always is a play, almost always. Uh-huh. So I don't know. I think you should get back into it. It's a lot of commitment, I know.
That's the thing. I wanted to try out for Rent. I really did, because that's a play that I think that I still have the capability of being able to do. But yeah, it's so much time.
It is.
So much time. And their run, we used to do like 8 or 10 shows, and the Rent run is like 17 shows. They're doing it like over a month for Sunnyvale. Favorite musical?
That's hard. I really love a lot of them. I don't know. I really like Cabaret.
Cabaret, yeah.
The stage version, not the... I like the movie, but it's not the same at all.
No, the stage version much better.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably more I love than I don't love at this point.
I love... Jesus Christ Superstar.
Well, yeah, that's
a given, right?
That's a given. I probably have named that as my favorite the most times, but it's kind of different too than.
Yeah, it does kind of stand. Yeah,
it's more of the rock opera,
right? It does kind of. It is its own thing.
I love Fiddler on the Roof.
Really?
Yeah,
that's never one I liked. Oh. I was traumatized by a performance of that I saw.
That's
when
the
I was
only
a
one
kid.
I've ever been in twice.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What were you?
I'm always just in the chorus. I was in eighth grade. I think I had a dance solo, and then in high school, I'm just in the chorus, a few lines here and there. But
that's awesome. I was never in that.
Why were you traumatized?
Because I saw that show is so, Tevye is such a big part of that show, and if you don't have a good one,
oh, that's true.
You know what I mean?
It is a lot resting on the Tevye.
If he's not good, that thing's going to fall apart like a Jenga puzzle, and it did. Mm. Really
yeah, somehow,
bad.
Like in eighth grade, he was really good, inexplicably. Like, it doesn't
really?
Seem like there should be a middle school Tevye that works.
That's awesome. I love that.
At least in my memory, I don't know. Maybe I'd feel differently today, but.
I don't know. There's plays that I thought I was good in, and if I looked at it now, I'd be like, oh my God, what was I doing? West Side Story is a favorite of mine.
I love West Side Story.
Guys and Dolls.
I wouldn't... Well, I have to revisit it. I was in it in, like, I don't know, third or fourth grade or something. I wouldn't say it's a favorite. It does have a lot of good songs, though. I could see you being in that.
The movie is... I played the same part. I did it
twice.
Were
you Sky?
Too. Yeah, Sky yeah. both times. That's where I became obsessed with Marlon Brando, because I watched the movie. But that's one of my favorites. What other ones were you in?
Oh, gosh. I was in a lot. My first one I was ever in was The King and I. I think I was only like 5 or 6.
Really?
And I still love The King and I. Like, the music to that's amazing. We just rewatched the movie not that long ago. And like, yeah, there's, you know, corny elements and stuff, but it's a really interesting true story, too. Like, you know, the king of Siam and stuff, like
yeah.
The fact that they were able to turn that into this iconic musical. And I was in Oliver. I love Oliver.
I was in Oliver. What were you in Oliver?
I was just, you know, orphan and pickpocket.
I was Mr. Bumble. The fat. It was at the end. That was the end of my stage.
Really?
Oh. Yeah, that was like one of the last plays I ever did because I like when I got that part, I was like, dude, am I so fat?
Fagin.
I was too fat. Fagin's like, you know, scrawny, poor, rough and tumble. I was this big fat guy.
I love Oliver. I think I tend to like British, you know, like how I love England in general.
Yes.
So all the, you know. But I think the music to Oliver is great. Like the Lionel Bart, he's one of my favorite lyricists. Like he was talking about rhymes earlier.
Yeah.
He's very, very good at rhymes.
of rhyming.
Yeah, and I think, like, if you're trying to think of influences for me, my songwriting, like, it's totally musical theater rooted.
Right.
It's like, they're the best. Like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like, there's something about that, that it's a, such a lost art of the way those guys would write, you know? I mean, there's so much, there's the whole, like, cliched idea of, like, guys, one guy sitting at a piano with a cigarette and the other guy, like, in suspenders over it. But it's true, though. Like, they really did that. Yeah. And, like, they busted their butts on those things,
yeah,
on those songs. And they're so good.
Yeah. Oh.
Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Irving Berlin.
Irving Berlin.
Like, crazy amount, like, thousands of songs. And they're, I mean, they're not all good, but... you know,
but for the most part, yeah, really, like, good. Cole Porter and, like, those guys, because that's something I've never been able to understand. Like, I think in those days too, it was such a workmanlike job that those guys would just write and write and write and write.
Yeah,
I can't even imagine how they could do that. You know what play I was in this twice, but Oklahoma is a play that I
find Oklahoma very creepy.
It's boring.
I was in Oklahoma too.
we should compare our resumes.
Again, nothing, you know, background. But who are you? Were you Curly or were
I
you?
I was Judd.
Okay. See, that has got to be one of the creepiest. Like, the poor Judd is dead.
That was one of my favorite parts that I ever played.
The
because
best
he's so
part.
Creepy.
Yeah.
Pure creepy evil. It was awesome.
Kind of, but then Curly. Like, he's, I don't know, we're supposed to like him, but he's pretty boring.
I was glad that I didn't play Curly,
yeah,
even though those were the parts that I always liked to play. And for those of you who don't know Oklahoma, there is a scene when this is so twisted, because you think Oklahoma, it's like Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, the wind goes sweeping down the plain. It is Rodgers and Hammerstein, right?
Yeah. Okay. I think it's one of their pretty early ones.
Yeah.
Second one, maybe.
But it's so twisted. So there's a scene... for those of you who haven't seen it, where the main romantic lead, Curly, goes and visits Judd, who is the bad guy. And Judd is the bad guy who wants Curly's girl. And
who's not even his girl, kind of.
It's that. It's the girl
it's
he's
not
courting.
Like he's, and they just pretend to hate each other. Like.
Right. But Judd is keen on her, and Judd's a psycho. So Curly goes into his little hovel and tries to convince him to kill himself.
Yeah.
And then, yeah,
and he almost does, like, he joins in, like...
He does, yeah, he gets into it. It's, like, that song is so twisted, it's really twisted, and it's, like, a really dark part of that play. And then I got to get killed on stage, which was nice. It was the only time I ever got to die on stage. But...
Didn't you die in West Side Story?
I think we all died, yeah. No, I was not a lead in West Side Story. I had one line.
Clear.
I don't know. I played a guy named Guitar, spelled G-E-E-T-A-R. And there's literally, in the script of West Side Story, Guitar is never mentioned. There's never a stage direction that says, like, action and this guy and that guy and Guitar enter the room. He's never mentioned, right? But there is one part where they're screaming at, what's her name? The sister?
Anita.
They're screaming at her, and then in the script, like, inexplicably, it says Guitar, and he screams Gold Tooth amongst all of the yelling. And obviously, everyone's yelling, so it's not like everyone stopped and gave me the opportunity to say Gold Tooth and then go on. So you never heard that line, which is fine. Like, I didn't care, but I just thought it was so funny. That they went to the trouble of, like, writing his name.
You or we should write the lost song, Gold Tooth.
For Guitar?
Yeah.
I broke my finger in that play when I was dead. Because someone, the cop or whoever is still alive at the end of it, walked over my middle finger.
And you really broke
and
it.
Twisted it. And you can still, for those of you listening, can't see it, but it's still all, I didn't go to a doctor. And it's healed wrong.
When we were, my high school Fiddler on the Roof, the guy playing Model, the tailor who has the wedding, they step on the glass to break it, and he totally, like, shredded his foot blood everywhere.
Really? Did you not have a shoe on?
He did, but I don't know. I guess it was not strong enough. But yeah, I've never been in West Side Story. I've been in Romeo and Juliet once. I think West Side Story is better, though.
I like West Side Story better. Shakespeare, to me, I always want to pretend that I like it.
Yeah. Because
I want to seem like I'm, you know, like the thespian and stuff.
And obviously, it's, you know, so much stuff has been based from it. And
yeah.
Vocabulary and stuff. But I think this, like, West Side Story is a lot more sad.
It is. It's done well. The production that I was in, something I really liked about it was that the director, this guy named John Healy, who was just a really, really good director. The way he ended it, maybe other productions do it this way, I don't know, but for this one, he ended it with a spotlight on the gun and then no curtain call. Mm. It was so cool. Like, spotlight on the gun and then lights went out, curtains closed, and that was it. So you just walk out of the theater feeling like, Jesus.
Yeah.
Everyone's dead.
That's what, like, when you see a really good production of Cabaret, like, it's so powerful, you know, when they start having, you know, the Nazi song, what's it called? Tomorrow Belongs to Me.
Yeah.
Like, that's a great song. Yeah. Like, you almost become a Nazi because it's so good. Right. Like,
right.
Like, you know, it's...
Yeah. I saw Sound of Music once, which is not one of my favorites either. I think only because I've heard those songs so many times. Yeah. But the scene, the production I saw, the scene where the Nazis come in, they came in through the audience, you know, so they walk down the aisles onto the stage and they, like, they open the door, like they slammed open the theater doors. So it was like terrifying, the sound, because it's like coming from the back of the theater, and then they, like, you know, they storm in. It's one of the most memorable things I've seen in a production.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, Oklahoma, that would probably be toward the bottom of my list.
Yeah, I think the first, there's so, like, it feels like 2 hours of that play take place just in front of that farmhouse.
Yeah.
With different people coming in and out, but it's just, basically, it's just that farmhouse all the time.
And there's, like, the whole weird dream ballet.
Oh, God, yeah. I was in that part, too. Judd comes into that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So what, like, what pro, like, super pro touring company, or have you seen something on Broadway ever?
I've seen a lot. My mom and her family are all from New Jersey, and the part of New Jersey really close to New York. So we used to go, like, every summer or Christmas, and so we'd see a show quite a few times. I think I saw. Yeah, I've seen a lot. I saw Jelly's Last Jam. I was obsessed with in, like, junior high.
Really?
It's like kind of like a biography of Jelly Roll Morton.
Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to see that.
Yeah, I loved that one. And I was really into tap dancing, like, growing up. And it's a lot of tap dance. It was really good. And it uses his real music, but with lyrics. And
right.
I saw The Lion King on Broadway.
How was that?
Which, it was really good. I never really liked the movie that much.
Really?
Yeah. I think just because, kind of like Sound of Music, like, when it came out.
That's true, too. Like, overexposed.
Everyone was always, it was their favorite movie. So I don't know if I was just being contrary or.
Yeah.
But the stage show is really cool. Like, the costumes and the way they do the puppets to make the animals.
That's something I really want to see that.
Yeah, it's worth it. I've seen it a few times, actually.
I saw Elton John's. He did a musical.
Oh right, I didn't even think. Of course,
That was him. He did a couple others. He did Aida, which was really good, and Billy Elliot, which I have not seen. But he did, him and Bernie Taupin wrote Lestat, the vampire Lestat. They wrote a musical of it, and so it previewed in San Francisco. So I went to opening night of it, and the songs and the lyrics to the songs were amazing, but it was like, there was no chorus, really. There was only a couple of scenes where there'd be, like, you know, more than three or four people on stage. Mm-hmm. So it was basically just like these two guys back and forth singing over and over again different songs that were cool, but in the end, like, that was it, you know. Yeah. And they had some cool lighting effects and stuff, but it they rewrote it a bunch, and then they got to Broadway and it closed. So I saw one of like the only seven performances of it. So that wasn't the highlight. I think the best professional play I've ever seen was Les Miserables in San Francisco.
That's one that has never been a favorite.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I like it. Actually, I saw that on Broadway, actually. And it was good. We were right in the front. And then actually my mom realized that the master of the house guy was actually a friend from high school.
Really?
So we got to talk to him after.
That's awesome.
But yeah, for some reason, that's always one that like it seems like would be a favorite. But for whatever reason, much like Morrissey.
Well, they're both depressing. I think yeah. That's one of the reasons I like Les Mis, because it's really...
It's Mis.
It's a dour, yeah. There was the thing I remember the most about that show was that when Javert commits suicide, he jumps off a bridge, and I'm sure they did it this way when you saw it, because it's Broadway. When he jumps off, the bridge is on ropes or whatever, and they pull it up, and then they have a mat behind him of stars that go up with it. So even though he's just standing on the stage, the bridge is going up and the stars are going up. So it looks like he's falling as he's singing and then the lights go out. And I was like, that's one of the coolest stage tricks I've ever seen. So Les Mis, any other winners for you?
I'm trying to think of ones I've seen like around here. Palo Alto Players did Chicago last fall. It was really, really good. That's another one of my favorites.
Chicago's great.
It's so funny and dark. But they were good. You know, you never know with, like, the local smaller theaters if they can pull it all off.
Right.
But
I'm always curious. I should go to more theater because there's so many times where I'll see an ad or a flyer or something for a play like that, like Chicago, or something that's a little more upscale, a little harder to pull off.
Yeah.
That a smaller theater company
is especially when it has like dancing
and
big numbers. They're doing Into the Woods right now.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it, but I just edited the review. She said it was really good. That's another one that a lot of people really love. I kind of like the idea more than the actual songs.
I totally agree.
But Stephen Sondheim's really good, another really good lyricist, I think.
There's not his finest lyrics in that. I think I remember I saw that play, and I just, for some reason, it's always sticks out that somebody comes in and sings, "I really hate to ask it, but do you have a basket?" And I just tuned out. There's a documentary about Sondheim. I don't remember what it's called. It came out a couple of years ago. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Uh-uh.
It's amazing.
I don't think so. I would like to see it though.
Oh, I'll figure it out. I'll find out what it is. It's so good because it's like interviews with him from when he was young. But then it's like cut in with interviews with him now. Yeah. And he talks about how he writes. He just gets into everything. And, it's so good. I think anyone who writes songs or likes musicals has to see it. It's like required.
Yeah. Hearing. I feel like, I guess I've seen that one. I've seen Merrily We Roll Along, which I love, if you've ever seen that one.
I have never seen that one.
You like it. The action all moves backward, so it goes back in time. So you kind of start out with the characters all kind of old and jaded. And then, you see in reverse. And I like the music in that. I don't know. I don't always find his melodies to be the most compelling, which for me is important.
Very, yeah.
The same thing as I feel about what I know about Morrissey, so.
You don't find Morrissey's melodies to be compelling?
And again, I haven't really listened to that much, so I feel like that's kind of the weakest link to me. Like, I like the lyrics and the music, but sometimes it just sounds like he's just, like, you can tell that the melody came last, maybe.
Right.
But again, that's very limited listening experience. So.
There are a lot of songs where he kind of almost, it's not monotone, but it's where I think one of the things that he likes to do that I enjoy is that you know, it doesn't appeal to everyone, but there's like a certain amount of tension that he kind of creates by not, there's not a lot of rise and fall in the melody. And then there'll come a point where the song like breaks and then it, you know, it spreads out into a bigger chorus. Not always. I mean, sometimes I think he's got really hooky stuff, but the other thing that's hard with him is that, like, even on the podcast I did with him, there's a ton of other stuff that he's done, like singles and things like that, that I couldn't even get to because he has so much stuff. So anytime you're that prolific, you're going to strike out a lot.
I don't know. We did There's a Light That Never Goes Out at Charlie's Wedding.
Yeah.
And that was really good. Like, I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's one of, I think that's one of his more accessible type songs. You know, there was more Smith songs like that probably than his own stuff.
Well, I'm going to give it a chance.
All right. I'll make a starter kit. I'll post a Morrissey playlist on the Pop Talk and Aliens Facebook page for everyone to
peruse. We could do a musical playlist too.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. We should. Top musicals and the best songs. So we'll make we'll make a playlist of best musicals and songs. Mm-hmm. And to me, also recordings are a big deal because, like, take Jesus Christ Superstar, like the original with Murray Head as Judas. There's another one, like an American cast recording. It's just like, it's garbage compared to that.
I really like the movie version, actually.
Really?
But I think that's an unpopular opinion. But then I've also had there's like later cast recordings too that are not the same
level. Charlie and I saw it at, I forget which theater, his dad's wife works worked, you know, Ruth worked like at
Orpheum.
Yeah. I think it was Orpheum. So we saw it there and there was, the guy who played Judas was really good. The whole production was really, really good. And I had never seen it on stage before, so I was, like, thrilled to see a good production of it.
Yeah. The original recording is really good, like the bass and drums and everything. Yeah, you can't really replicate,
like, I think that it's more of
60s sound.
Yeah. The way it's recorded and everything, it's like an album. Yeah. So it's hard to, it's hard to duplicate that. Chess was one of my favorite musicals. You know that one at all?
I've never seen it. I know Coy likes it.
I've never seen it.
That's like the ABBA.
Yeah, guys, ABBA, right? Yeah. And Tim Rice.
Tim Rice is another of my favorite lyricists, like his rhymes.
Yeah. Just
so British.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You do have totally have the British influence. Did you guys play it at the Cavern Club?
Uh-huh.
How was that? Must have been amazing. That was really fun. I've bugged Charlie about it, but what do you think? What was it like?
I mean, it kind of is the real one, it's kind of not. Because they recreated it.
Mm.
So it's like on the side of it, but it's not like, you know, they recreated like the wall that you see. In the...
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's just, there's something cool about it.
But you're in that spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're in Liverpool, you know.
That's amazing.
But it's all like a Disneyland of Beatles now. Like they call it the Cavern Quarter.
Oh, really?
Like everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. Chess is so good. And then, it's the same type of thing with Jesus Christ Superstar. They made a recording of it before the play came out. Also Murray Head, One Night in Bangkok. And it played in London for a while. And I think it came to America. It didn't do very well, but they rewrote it for America. And then there's an American cast version that sucks. It's so bad. And then they cut like half of the good songs. And years later, like not even that long ago, Tim Rice and ABBA put together a concert version of the original, like where they went back and like just erased the American version from history and redid the London version in a concert. And they had like Idina Menzel was in it and all these like Broadway stars. So it was like they brought it back to life and it didn't tour or anything, but just to like, there's a video and a CD of it that I got. And it was really nice to hear. Because it's one of those things that I feel like always floats under the radar. And, and nobody, like, everyone knows One Night in Bangkok as a pop song.
Yeah.
But in the context of that play, it's awesome. Well, Carla, I thank you so much for your time. Everyone is going to be very excited to hear this. And Octavia, who is now almost asleep, but the evidence of her is all over the floor. We have her blue microphone, her scepter. the piggy, the duck. Is that Winnie the Pooh?
It's Daniel Tiger.
Oh, okay.
From Mr. Rogers.
Oh, that's right. I remember him. Well, Carla, thank you. We'll put together a playlist. And
we're going to write Gold Tooth.
We're going to write Gold Tooth. Now we have a song to write. Gold Tooth.
You could retell the whole story from guitar's perspective.
Guitar has to have a story. It's not fair. It's not fair that they would go to the trouble of writing his name and he has no story. He's just like blends in to the background. Nobody ever says, hey, guitar, get over here. It's not fair.
He has a lot to say, I think.
I think so. And he was trying to use that opportunity when everyone was yelling to like have his voice heard. He has a little social anxiety. And he was trying to get like to, you know, be noticed, but it was too late. Everyone was just too angry at Anita at that point. Borderline rape scene.
Yeah.
Pretty intense. West Side Story. Well, Carla, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll talk to Coy soon, maybe. Here, maybe with Casey. I should get all. What I really want to do is get like the all star Pop Talking Aliens where I get all of you guys.
That would be fun.
It's going to be like 3 hours though, so we'll have to set aside some time.
To get babysitters for that.
Yeah.
Into place.
Yeah. We'll get babysitters into place. This is Pop Talking Aliens. I'm William Clear. This has been Carla Kane and briefly Coy Nguyen and beautiful Octavia, who has come in and out to join us. Cue the hot chick.
Pop Talk and Aliens, the William Clear Podcast.